recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
But for us, in trying to sort out who's good and who's bad, it seems like both of them are kind of lousy. But the thing with Vanderbilt, though, it's very interesting. The idea of competition, which now we think of as good, he saw as embedded within a larger Jacksonian value, the pursuit of self-interest. And you have to remember, he came of age in an America when you had hierarchical property requirements for voting. In New York, until the 1820s, you had to have one level of property to vote for the state assembly, and you had to have a higher level to vote for governor. It was a hierarchical society. And the people who had always dominated that society didn't see a world of a fair playing field, level playing field where everybody could rise. No, they wanted that hierarchy to stay in place. The idea of everyone being able to pursue their self-interest was actually, again, a part of this very Jacksonian, individualistic, egalitarian idea. Well, Vanderbilt, of course, got involved in more than steamships. As I mentioned, during the Civil War, he sold off all of his ships and went into railroads at the age of 69. And this begins to take us into a new and emerging world of the corporate economy. And here we really begin to see where today's world starts to take shape. Corporate ethics at the time were a starker form of many of the conflicts that we see today. And as an example of that, I'd like to mention this fellow over here. Oops, I just went back. Excuse me. This fellow over here was a good friend of Vanderbilt's, Daniel Drew, who, by the way, was a devout Methodist. I can say that. This is a Presbyterian school. So he was also completely unethical when it came to business. Vanderbilt was friends with him, but he also knew to keep him at arm's length. In 1844, for example, Daniel Drew bought control of a small railroad, the Mohawk and Hudson, one of the early railroads in America. And the reason was so that he could, you know, direct its traffic over his steamboat line on the Hudson. Okay, we would call that synergy today, merging two business interests. However, he explained in a lawsuit that one of the reasons for buying the control of this railroad was to obtain, quote, the profits to be derived from the purchase and sale of stock. We call this inside trading today, where you use your inside information as a corporate official. Before the public knows what's going to happen, you can buy or sell your own company's stock to make a profit. Now, was this illegal at the time? No. The reason we know about it is not that Drew was prosecuted in court. It's that he was sued because he didn't divide the profits fairly with his partners. The guy who sued was Vanderbilt's son-in-law. Vanderbilt put him in Drew's office because he knew Drew had to be watched. So, in the 1850s, Drew went on to become the treasurer of the Erie Railway, which was one of the largest companies in America. Huge. Again, this is like being treasurer of ExxonMobil today, or CFO of ExxonMobil. Well, the first credit bureau in America said of Drew, he is inside, that is, inside the management of the Erie Railway, and knows its fluctuations and bearings, and he is shrewd enough to take good care of himself. He may therefore be regarded as reliable for his debts. On Wall Street in the 1850s, his inside trading did not make him a pariah. It made him a good credit risk. So this is the kind of Wild West world of the 1850s. Corporate officials demonstrating what economists call the principal-agent problem. They're in charge of other people's money, and yet they can manage it for their own interests. Drew often did this incredibly ruthlessly. In the, let's see, does the next one, yes. So here we have a map. This is the Erie Railway right here. So at the time, a gigantic railroad in the 1850s. So in 1866, Daniel Drew, as treasurer, discovered that the Erie Railway was short on cash. So Daniel Drew, as private financier, lent the company $3.5 million, back when $3.5 million was a lot of money in corporate terms. You can still give me $3.5 million, I'll thank you. But in corporate terms, it was equivalent to many billions today. Well, so Daniel Drew, the private financier, wanted collateral. Daniel Drew, the treasurer, gave himself 58,000 unissued shares of stock. No reporting requirements. The stock market did not know they even existed. So what happened is, with this collateral in his safe, Daniel Drew went out and began to sell Erie short. That is, he began to make contracts to sell large amounts of Erie stock at $90 a share. Then all at once, he pulled all these shares out of his safe that no one knew about, threw them on the market. The price collapsed down to $57 a share. Daniel Drew then carefully and cautiously bought all the shares back and thus made a profit by dropping down the stock price of his own company by almost 50%. Well, at the time, it made him a hero. It was an operation which was regarded as a masterpiece, wrote Charles Francis Adams, Jr. And what worries me is that in recent years, I think it would have made him a hero today as well. But still, this sort of behavior today is regarded as not only illegal, but really outrageous behavior. But it shows the kind of inherent tendencies that happen when you're put in charge of other people's money in an era where there's no oversight, no transparency whatsoever. Vanderbilt, on the other hand, really believed that it was in his own interests, as well as in the interest of his stockholders, to be an honest manager of money. This man who was so ruthless, who was such a vicious competitor, also believed, again, I don't think out of sentiment, I think out of a sense of pride and also a sense that it was to his interests to be honest. He was once asked to make a written agreement when he came to terms with someone, and Vanderbilt said, no, you know that my word is as good as my bond. And that's from a letter that I found written the day that he made these remarks. So he prided himself on being a man of his word. And when he was in charge of a corporation, he prided himself on taking care of his stockholders' interests. But at the same time, he was ruthless, and he lived in a ruthless world. In 1868, we see these corporate ethics in Vanderbilt's business practices come to a head in one of the most notorious incidents in American business history, the Erie War. Now, the Erie War began, and again, it was fought right after Vanderbilt took control of he had already controlled these lines by the mid-1860s. 1867, he took control of the New York Central. So he had a line, what they call the trunk line, one of the four trunk lines across the Appalachians from Buffalo down to New York City. Erie is one of its four main competitors. So this man, Jay Gould, up there, and this guy, Jim Fisk, approached Vanderbilt in 1867 and said, we represent a set of stockholders who want to buy control of the Erie Railway. And understandably, they wanted to kick Daniel Drew off the board of directors. Vanderbilt hemmed and hawed. Finally, when Drew made some promises to Vanderbilt, Vanderbilt said, no, I'm not going to support you, because he had stock in the Erie too. So they made a deal. Gould, Fisk, and their partners took control of the Erie, but they allowed Drew to remain. But then, Drew being Drew, he reneged on some of the promises he had made to Cornelius Vanderbilt. Now, for Vanderbilt, this was not surprising, but it was also infuriating. As he once told the New York State Legislature in 1867, Vanderbilt said, I am not afraid of my enemies, but my God, you must look out when you get among your friends. Well, that was no more true of anyone than Daniel Drew. He cheated some of Vanderbilt's friends, he failed to live up to some bargains, and he was short-selling Erie again, which he'd promised not to do. So, again, trying to drive down the stock price. This bothered Vanderbilt for a lot of reasons I won't go into. So Vanderbilt decided to corner the stock. This is important for a couple of reasons. One is that Vanderbilt is known as this great business manager, as a creator of businesses, someone who really, he understood how the price of coal affected operations, how, you know, competitive pricing worked, all of these management, organizational and operational management decisions. But he came of age, like Drew, with the stock market itself. That picture I showed you early on that showed Wall Street, that showed the early stock market. It was literally four or five guys trading two or three bonds and stocks. That's the way the stock market worked when Vanderbilt started. By the time this age comes around, it's already a large market with hundreds of thousands of investors working through dozens, if not hundreds, of brokers, with telegraphed orders arriving on Wall Street. It's much more like a modern financial market. But the psychology of the market remained very much the same, and Vanderbilt understood it. One of his great operations was the corner. When someone was short selling and they were trying to sell high and then later buy it back at a low price, Vanderbilt would corner the market. He'd buy every possible share. So when those people came time to buy back the shares, I won't go into all the details, there were none to be had. And they couldn't make their short selling deliveries and they get caught, cornered. So it was a nervy maneuver. It took a lot of money and it took determination because you really had to buy everything, which meant you had to stretch your credit and have good credit. Vanderbilt had all of those qualities. Iron nerve, lots of money, and the ability to put together combinations of stock market players. So he decided to corner Erie in 1868. Now, what to do about Daniel Drew and all those shares that he had in his safe? Well, Vanderbilt went to the most corrupt judge in New York, Judge George Barnard, the special friend of Boss Tweed of Tammany Hall, whom he probably knew was majorly invested in the stocks that Vanderbilt cared about as well. And so he got injunctions from George Barnard, basically stopping Drew from doing anything. No selling bonds, no selling stock, no trading in stock, no functioning as a director, et cetera, et cetera, to give him legal cover so that Drew could not wreck Vanderbilt's corner. Well, what happened is the fellows who are now formerly enemies, Jay Gould, Jim Fisk, and Daniel Drew, now became pals. They were all on the Erie board together, and Cornelius Vanderbilt's going into the stock market, starting to buy all of the stock. Well, they don't care about the fact that it's a personal vendetta against Drew, that he wants a corner Drew in the stock market. They're thinking they're going to lose control of the Erie Railway, which they just took over, and they've got to stop it. Drew, meanwhile, wants to avoid being bankrupted in the stock market by Vanderbilt. So they go find their own judge. New York State allowed different judges overlapping jurisdictions, so they would all issue injunctions against each other. So that's what they did. They went out and they got a bunch of injunctions. Then they began to find ways to just manufacture stock. And there are a lot of legal ways in which they did it. But it was illegal in the end. A, there was a judge who had told them they couldn't do it. B, New York State law required shareholders to vote on and approve new shares. Didn't matter. They just went ahead and did it. They had their own injunctions, and they began to dump stock. Vanderbilt's buying all this stock, and yet more stock appears. And it just keeps coming. And he doesn't even know where it's coming from. And it's being delivered through front men. Again, everything is a secret on Wall Street. And he's trying to find out what. And he's being pushed to the wall because he has to buy in credit. And pretty soon, he's stretched to the absolute limit. Well, fortunately for him, at just this time, Judge Barnard, who probably also was stretched to the limit, issued arrest warrants. The officers of the Erie Railway, one of the nation's largest corporations, ran out the door of the office trying to escape being arrested. The New York Herald said, a regular stampede took place among the Erie officials, each one lugging off an account book, desk drawer, or as much of the red tape tied documents as they could be grasped in the hurry of the moment. With the bales of stock and greenbacks, they hustled onto a steamboat ferry, sailed over to New Jersey, and set up shop in the Taylor Hotel, soon dubbed Fort Taylor by the press. Jay Gould and Jim Fisk lingered for a couple of days, dining at Delmonico's. When the police came to get them, they had to run down to the dock, hire an open boat, which later was swamped in the fog by a ferry boat, and they had to grasp the rails. This is rather like, in 2008, if the officials of AIG or Citibank had left their headquarters grasping onto the skids of a helicopter, trying to avoid being arrested and escaping to another state. So, the nation was completely agog at this whole process. Again, there are only a handful of really large corporations. And here they are, they're forced to flee New York State. They're pumping out tens of thousands of shares completely illegally. And so the New York State legislature started to get involved. Well, the New York State legislature was not known for being particularly honest itself. In fact, a senator wonderfully named Abner C. Mattoon went to see the Erie Railroad directors at Fort Taylor. And he told them, well, you know, there's a bill being readied, two bills, one that would basically condemn the Erie and take away your control of it, and the other that would legalize your issues of shares on the theory that Vanderbilt would obtain a monopoly on New York State railroads, and that's a bad thing. And all this time, this guy, Jim Fisk, was the public face. Jay Gould was sly, cunning. He was secretive. Very, very quiet and cunning fellow, the mastermind. Jim Fisk knew how to play to the crowd. He was funny. He was outrageous. Nobody knew about his wife, but everybody knew about his mistress, kept in a fancy hotel room. And he talked about how their struggle was for the poor. The Erie struggle against Vanderbilt was to help the poor. So Abner C. Mattoon said, we legislators are quite poor. We can barely survive on what we make. Daniel Drew declared, the inference I drew was that he would take money if it was offered to him. Well, they could see the handwriting on the wall. Jay Gould went to Albany, the New York State Capitol, with a suitcase full of greenbacks. When an official came to arrest him, now that he was in New York State, he said to the constable, I'll still be in your custody if you stay here with me at the hotel. And so he went from being the arresting officer to his bodyguard. Literally a line formed out the door of his hotel room as he wrote out checks and handed out cash. As he put it, he gave $5,000 to one fellow just to sort of smooth things over. Well, on April 20th, the New York State Assembly took up a bill to legalize the Erie shares. They had previously defeated it, but after Drew's intervention, it passed 101-5 and was signed into law by the New York State governor. Well, at this point, you would think that Vanderbilt, the honest man, within this context at least, has been defeated. But these guys wanted to come back to New York, and there were still arrest warrants out. So Daniel Drew began to come back and make secret visits to Vanderbilt's house. And here we see a curious thing. Friendship actually mattered. Drew and Vanderbilt were able to come to terms after this huge outlandish battle that had dominated headlines across the country. And they agreed that Vanderbilt would get his money back. He wouldn't get control of the Erie Railway, but he'd get his money back. Drew agreed that he would step down from control of the Erie Railroad. Everybody got a chunk of money. The Erie was left basically bankrupt, and so they left it to these two guys. Control of one of the largest and most bankrupt railroads in America. Well, this story illustrates a few things. Like I said, how personal connections, as much as it was becoming a sophisticated financial market, it still was a world small enough where personal connections mattered. The way people understood each other mattered. Vanderbilt said to Jay Gould and to Jim Fisk that basically Drew had no backbone, and if they hadn't come in, that he would have had it all his own way. And I think that's true. As a result, Jay Gould became the one enemy of Vanderbilt's life, a life full of enemies, who he never could reconcile with. He hated Jay Gould. Once a reporter asked him whether he was in business with Jay Gould about some matter on Wall Street, and he said, he was outraged, and he leaped up and he said, you can publish it in your newspaper that I said Jay Gould is a damned villain. Then as the reporter was walking down the steps, Vanderbilt came to the door and said, remember, I said he was a damned villain. Get it right. This is totally uncharacteristic, but it reflects, again, that particular role that Gould played in Vanderbilt's biggest defeat, and also the way in which these personal relationships mattered so much in an unregulated world. Well, another aspect that comes out about this is two things. When we come to reactions to the Erie War, well, as I've told the story, one of the biggest reactions you would think would be the just gross, self-serving illegality of the way the Erie directors handled this whole thing. When they acted against the law, and they acted against the interests of their shareholders. But one of the strongest reactions was not against their illegality, but against Vanderbilt's potentially controlling the two major railroads in New York State. In July 1869, one of the most important pieces of financial journalism ever published, in the North American Review, by Henry Adams' brother, Charles Francis Adams, Jr., it's called A Chapter of Erie. And he wrote, already our great corporations are fast emancipating themselves from the state, or rather subjecting the state to their own control. In this dangerous path of centralization, Vanderbilt has taken the latest step in advance. Vanderbilt is but the precursor of a class of men who wield within the state a power created by it but too great for its control. He is the founder of a dynasty. In essence, Vanderbilt's power, by being the very skillful and determined head of a very large corporation, when large corporations were a new thing under the sun, when there was something that Americans of an earlier day, like Henry J. Raymond, had never dealt with, that power was far more frightening than the run-of-the-mill illegality that Fisk and Gould represented. And it started a new debate over the power of corporations and how public interests and private interests could conflict. In 1867, for example, Vanderbilt took control of the New York Central Railroad, which, again, as I mentioned, is that crosses the span. That's the trunk line he took over. He took it over by shutting down all rail traffic into New York City. He owned the only railroads that actually entered New York City, and so he could cut off the Central from connection to the nation's largest port and largest city. Also, this was during a winter blizzard when ships and ferries were unable to reach New York. With one blow, one man cut off the nation's largest city from contact with the rest of the country. Around this event, it only lasted a few days. He knew what he was doing, but still it was a frightening few days. This became the focal point of a debate that sounds very much like the one we're having right now about the private interests and the conflict with the public interests. Whether the government, when I say state, I mean just government in general, whether government should step in to regulate so that private disputes don't affect the public. New York State began to discuss just such a bill, and Vanderbilt reacted to it in a very curious way. He said, if you could pass a law compelling men to take better care of their interests, then their interests will compel them without the law, then it is well enough. Essentially, he defined the public interests as everyone pursuing their private interests as aggressively as possible. And for that to work, he had to be free to punish people who were not following their best interests, because it was never in anyone's best interest to cross Cornelius Vanderbilt. So if he had to cut off New York for a few days, that's the price you pay for the public interest, which is everybody pursuing their private interests. He doesn't see a separation between the two. Now, there are a lot of people who, you know, very much believe this today, and it's very much a part of our debate. But what's interesting is that the other side of the spectrum really is emerging for the first time during Vanderbilt's lifetime. The radicals in his youth had opposed government intervention because they saw that as rewarding the wealthy and established people. Now that you've got giant corporations, people are saying maybe we need the government to step in and regulate their power. No matter how you fall in this argument, this is where it starts. Now, there's one other thing about the Erie War I want to mention before I wrap up. And that is the whole aspect of finance, the morality of finance. There's a thing called stock watering, which was a big deal. It was a great term of abuse by writers in the 19th century. Stock watering basically means increasing the number of shares in a company. Well, of course, that's what the Erie directors did. And we can see why it was bad. It diluted the shares, the stake each shareholder had in the corporation. If you had 1,000 shares and one shareholder has 100 shares, and the directors add another 1,000, you know, your stake is lowered. It also lowered the stock price, so you're doubly hurt. And then also they handled it illegally as well. Vanderbilt, however, in 1868, carried out what we would now call a stock split, where he gave 8 new shares for every 10 that someone had. Not only that, but he continued to pay dividends on that stock at the same absolute rate, $8 a share. You now had 80% more shares. You got the same $8 on those new shares. And because of this, the stock price actually went up because the market was so impressed. So how could this not be good? It was fair. It benefited everybody financially. The market loved it. And yet it was condemned by people like Charles Francis Adams Jr. as stock watering. The reason is that their idea of what a corporation and a share was is rooted in an earlier era, before you had these financial abstractions which are now dominating the scene. This is a debate they had which has new resonance for us in the wake of the financial disaster. When mortgage-backed securities, the value of mortgage-backed securities became completely separated from the value of the actual land that was being mortgaged and bundled together in these mortgage-backed securities. As stocks began to be a regularly traded item, they took on their own value, fluctuating up and down in the market. But in theory, they should represent, they thought, $100 per share spent on actual stuff, land, capital, locomotives, whatever, physical stuff. If you increase the number of shares in a company without increasing the amount of actual stuff, then it's a fraud. Now, in our mindset, we're so comfortable with the ideas of financial abstractions that it's kind of hard to wrap your mind around. The idea that a share of stock represents $100 of stuff. But this was critical to their view of the world, a view of the world which was just beginning to grapple with the financial abstractions that today dominate our world and that now we're looking at anew, afresh. Now, I just want to briefly mention, so I have time for questions, one of the ways in which one episode in Vanderbilt's life brought together these questions of corporate power and the new abstraction of finance and how dangerous it seemed. When he took control of the New York Central, he needed a connection to Chicago. Well, he had friendly relations with the railroads that ran along the North Shore of Lake Erie, so that's good. But this new railroad formed, very long, very important railroad, in 1869 called the Lake Shore, or Lake Shore in Michigan Southern. Vanderbilt, he didn't feel the need to control it, but he wanted it to be friendly to him. So he bought a lot of stock, sent one of his sons-in-law, who are always his agents, to the first meeting of the board of directors. They ran into resistance from this guy, who Vanderbilt had fought with before in Wall Street, the prestigious patrician member of the New York elite, LeGrand Lockwood, who was the treasurer. Well, soon Vanderbilt found out why Lockwood was opposing everything Vanderbilt wanted to do in the Lakeshore. He'd made an alliance with these two guys. Remember, they've got control of the Erie Railway, and they're trying to actually make it into something. So they need a connection to Chicago. Well, Jim Fisk, as you remember, was the flamboyant one, the entertainer. He actually bought an opera house for use as the company offices. So they take LeGrand Lockwood to dinner at Delmonico's, then the fanciest restaurant in New York. They go up to West Point, which was also a summer resort, not just a military academy, and not in the same facilities, but the same town. And they make a deal. The Lakeshore will essentially fall into the orbit of the Erie, and it will send all of their trains over the Erie Railway. The Erie will pay for this and that, etc. Vanderbilt was frozen out. Well, Vanderbilt was a very clever fellow and very patient one. So he waited because he knew that the way finances worked, you can read it for yourself if you care. If you don't, it's all right. The way finances worked, Wall Street would run into trouble in the fall. It was an agricultural country. Money got tight in the fall. There was a finite amount of actual currency, which each bank had to hold in reserve. And in the fall, all those farmers needed the currency for their harvest and shipping of goods. So they drained down deposits made in reserve banks in New York. So the stock market always got weak. There wasn't a lot of credit available in New York in the fall. So Vanderbilt waited. And then, just when the money market seemed tight enough, he dumped all of his stock in Lakeshore stock on the market all at once. This caused a crisis in Lakeshore value. The New York Herald said, due to Vanderbilt, the whole course and tendency of prices have been reversed with magic-like power. On October 1st, LeGrand Lockwood, one of the great powers of Wall Street, whose mansion is still a state park in Norwalk, Connecticut today, went bankrupt. Rather astounding. Rather like, say, AIG going bankrupt. It was a major event. Vanderbilt then went outside of the U.S. money market to Baring Brothers, borrowed a large amount of money from the British banks, went into the stock market, bought back his own stock at reduced prices, bought back all of Lockwood's stock, now that he was bankrupt, and a lot of other stock too, got control of the Lakeshore. So he bankrupted an opponent, got control of a major railroad, made a profit on the stock market, and all he had to do was contribute to a major financial panic to do it. That was Black Friday, September 24th, 1869. Now, this was actually a whole other story I won't go into. Jay Gould, also with a deep understanding of the financial world at that time, was trying to corner the gold market, which is kind of like trying to corner the financial currency exchange. Just astounding effort at the time. And finally, again, when money was getting tight, the federal government stepped in and dumped a bunch of gold on the market and caused the corner to collapse. Jay Gould and Jim Fisk were lucky to survive. One broker shot himself. Jim Fisk said the scene was every man drag out his own corpse. Vanderbilt actually contributed to this famous panic with his collapse of the stock market. But then he did something else. Vanderbilt went to Wall Street very publicly, which he never did, walked around the exchange and gave orders to buy stock. One stockbroker said, "I know it, I knew it, I knew it, the old rat never deserts his friends." The New York World said, "The best men on the street all assert that had it not been for the Commodore coming to the rescue, the panic would have been 100-fold greater and led to something like what we've just gone through with our Great Recession." So such was Vanderbilt's disproportionate power that he not only contributed to a panic, but he was able to help arrest it at the end. Now, again, when we talk about the ethics of this, you know, this really was a wake-up call for a lot of Americans to how the financial markets now really are affecting the real economy in ways, again, that we're more familiar with now. Vanderbilt, on one hand, was able to create a consolidated railroad empire, largely consolidated in two main pieces, between New York and Chicago. What he did with it as a businessman benefited the United States in enormous, indisputable ways. He created new infrastructure, like the first Grand Central, with these vast rail yards where New York City had never had before. He created, this advertises an unprecedented four-track line. So you had two freight tracks running each way, two passenger tracks, led to great efficiencies. He lowered costs, sped up transit. He made Americans more mobile. He made the economy more productive. And his investors all made money, even after the panic of 1873, when half the nation's railroads went bankrupt. His railroads made dividend paying automatic. The boards of directors stopped voting on it. So Vanderbilt, as a businessman, because of these high-stakes battles, contributed to the rapid growth and development of the United States after the Civil War. But at the same time, each of these battles hurt a lot of people along the way. And the fact is that with a corporation, again, not only between the corporation and the public do you sometimes have conflicts, within the corporation, the Lakeshore investors were innocent bystanders, most of them. Yet they got hurt too when Vanderbilt crushed LeGrand Lockwood. People who lived in New York or invested in the New York Central Railroad, they got hurt when Vanderbilt blockaded New York City. So the new power of the corporation and the new conflicts of financial interests within the corporation really begin to blossom in the American mind. And this is where a lot of our great debate begins. But there's one last aspect I want to mention before I take questions. I haven't run over it quite yet. And that's this deep cultural ferment that surrounds this whole question of financial abstractions. You know, in for most of human history, business, for the vast majority of people, except for a small, tiny handful, business, the economy, was physical and real. Businesses were individual people or small groups of investors. Even the word company in the 19th century until well into the 19th century was a plural noun. Because they thought of a company as a small group of individuals. They said, the company are doing this. The company are going to pay their debts. It was a plural noun. It was a group. Because you didn't have many large companies before the 19th century. You know, property was physical stuff. It was a physical, tangible world. And in the 19th century, the average person more and more began to deal with financial abstractions. Money went from being precious metal coin that was intrinsically valuable to paper notes that merely represented coin that you hoped you could trade in for coin. And then during the Civil War, to just being simply a pure intellectual abstraction, not redeemable for coin at all. Stock was supposedly worth $100 of physical stuff, but the stock market began to take it off and do unusual things with it. Daniel Drew was a great master of the derivative, selling calls and puts, where you bought the right to buy a share at a, or to sell a share at a certain price. This financial world fascinated, among others, Herman Melville. In The Confidence Man, he used the financial metaphor as a way of exploring the tension between the physical world, which he saw as famously a pasteboard mask, and that unreachable metaphysical reality beyond. And in The Confidence Man, he actually has a scene where somebody gets a counterfeit detector to help figure out which notes are real and fake. And you begin to realize the counterfeit detector itself is counterfeit. That's a very Melville sort of metaphor. So that in Moby Dick, and that's actually, I know that's Captain Picard. That's actually, that's supposed to be Captain Ahab. The talisman for the white whale, the ultimate unreachable reality, is a gold coin. Americans in the antebellum era would have understood what that meant, the financial metaphor. And it shows how these new abstract realities were shaking the American mind so deeply. Now, the question, of course, is, you know, are we going through another one of these moments where the financial abstraction have shaken us after the most recent crisis, when all of a sudden we're realizing just how flimsy and how ephemeral are the values of financial securities, as well as we long saw how powerful they can be, which they can be, and now we've seen how flimsy they can be as well. Is there a crisis? Will 50 years from now we see our views changing now? I'm not sure, but it could well be one of those moments. The last thing I want to say about Vanderbilt is just to say something in defense of him, not morally, but I think substantively. This is a very brief passage, and then I'll take questions from my book, where I talk about him at mid-century, just before the California Gold Rush in 1848. Vanderbilt, the boorish boatman, as he was called, because he had been one, suffered a great deal from the condescension of the New York elite, even though they did business with him because they had to. But I note it is a mistake to simply adopt the condescension and derision of the contemporary social elite. Their view ignores a critical fact. Vanderbilt's business career, beginning in the first half of the 19th century, was an act of imagination. In the age of the corporation's infancy, he and his fellows created a world of the mind, a world that would last into the 21st century. At a time when even many businessmen could not see beyond the physical, the tangible, they embraced abstractions never known before in daily life. They saw that a group of men sitting around a table could conjure, quote, an artificial being, invisible, intangible, that is, a corporation, that could outlive them all. They saw how stocks could be driven up or dropped in value, how they could be played like a flute to command more capital than the incorporators could muster on their own. They saw that everything in the economy could be further abstracted into a substanceless something that might be bought or sold, that a banknote or a promissory note or the right to buy a share of stock at a certain price could all be traded at prices that varied from day to day. The subtle eye of the boorish boatman saw this invisible architecture and grasped its innumerable possibilities. Thank you very much.
Well, we have a few minutes for questions, and you probably noticed that we do have books available for purchase and signing out in the lobby after we're done with the Q&A. So, questions for Sister Stiles? Jim?
I'm tempted to ask you, based on what you know of the stock market now, do you stick
to
money in that?
Yeah, I have to say, I have been cautious, actually. You know, but I always say my stock market advice is, you know, buy New York Central and hold.
Okay.
You know, but that company stopped existing in the 1950s.
We have a number of future writers here, and I was hoping you would talk a little bit about your process, what you went through in researching this book, and how you worked in writing it.
Well, that's a wide open question, so I'll try to be brief. Selection of a subject is extremely important. I think that you can't escape yourself, that there are certain interests that appeal to you. Often it's not one overriding thing, but there are various questions that are there. I do write for a living, so, you know, a subject has to be well known enough for it to actually have an audience. But as I was mentioning when we were having dinner earlier, the way I see that is not chasing after a commercial subject. It's taking what I'm interested in and then thinking about how it can be bigger. You know, finding an iconic figure who lives large in the American imagination. So I wouldn't write about somebody I don't care about, but if I find, when I have something I'm passionate about, finding somebody who interests me and also plays this larger role takes my interest to a larger level rather than diminishing them commercially. So that's how I go about approaching that. But I really think it's important to, you can't escape yourself. When it comes to writing, I think it's very important to really think about the reader at all times, to give them a reason to turn every page. So when I present contextual information, I couch it within passages that that basically prep you for it and say, you need to know this to understand the stakes, to see how big what we're talking about, the events are. And then the reader will give me a little space, I think, to step aside and say, this is the world that they're in, and this is why a lot is going on here. But, you know, creating expectations and fulfilling them, one definition of plot, I think, is really important. And then finally, you know, really, I could go on forever, but it really, the research has to be right. And I really think that you have to be honest and skeptical. And there's a lot of emphasis on writing finely detailed scenes in narrative nonfiction these days. All of those details have to be true. E.M. Forster said that contrasted history with fiction by saying fiction is truer than history because history can only deal, and he meant nonfiction really, with the surfaces. And we all know there's something below the surface. Well, it's very true. But the power of nonfiction to show you what's beneath the surface rests like a good actor upon those surface details. So your authenticity and your authority in suggesting what's going on beneath the surface, even though you can't know definitively, rests upon an accurate rendering of how people are reacting, what they're doing, all those surface details. And so, you know, I just reviewed a book, the review hasn't appeared yet, which to me was suspiciously detailed, and I looked up the sources and I couldn't find these details. And to me that's terrible because it destroys the authority for being more profound about the character. So really being true to your being precise with your sourcing is extremely important in nonfiction.
Thank you for your great presentation. You made the case that Vanderbilt's principles derived more from his business interest, being good business, than any intrinsic morality or altruism. Yet he seems to stand in such contrast with all the other characters you've introduced tonight. Where do those principles come from?
That's actually a very good question. I think that I wouldn't say he was deprived of all morality, but he definitely saw morality in an economic light. You know, it served his interests, and he was also inextricably mingled with pride as well. So his pride in being a man of his word was enormously important. His other great sentiment was that he was deeply patriotic. And so I note that, you know, pride and patriotism explain that he named his three sons after his three heroes, George Washington, William Henry after William Henry Harrison, and Cornelius Vanderbilt. So that's very much Vanderbilt. He was not a religious man. He actually one case where a priest came into Grand Central, and the treasurer told the story later, and he said, you know, here's $20. I saw somebody steal it from the railroad, and I wanted to give it back. So Vanderbilt, you know, says thanks, and he stands there and starts talking about how poor his parish is, and Vanderbilt just stares him down, and he leaves. And Vanderbilt then looks at the 20 and turns to the treasurer and says, well, there's some good in religion after all. You know, one other thing he got a big kick out of, he wore this, you know, notice that white cravat that he's wearing. And he wore that in old age at a time when it was mostly clergymen who wore that. So people who didn't recognize him, he's very distinguished, 6 feet tall when most men are my height. Not tall. And he was often mistaken for a clergyman with his bearing and with that white cravat. So once he was on an omnibus, you know, horse-drawn bus through New York, and two kind of street toughs sit across from him. And they look at him, and one of them says, I suppose you think I'm going to hell. And he says, well, you know, you seem to have some pretty good stuff in you. I guess you'll turn out all right. He shakes his head, looks at his partner, and says, universalist, by God. So, you know, it's a very evangelical era, and Vanderbilt was not one of them. And yet, you know, he donated $1 million to Vanderbilt University, which was, I think, a Southern Methodist university, because he had a family connection to the bishop, but he also trusted that bishop. He wanted to do something for the South, but he wanted somebody to manage his money correctly. And so even in his philanthropy, which was genuine, this business sense, the business ethics, filled even the philanthropy. And the requirement of the gift was that as chancellor of the university, he would have absolute authority, and the Bishop McTeer would not be answerable to the Board of Trustees. Now, you know, there are a lot of university presidents who would really like that today. So you know, it's very interesting how there's really no separation for him from business ethics and larger ethics and self-image. I can't see through the light, so if anybody has questions.
Let me ask you if you can imagine how he would look at business practices today, and are there things that are going on that he would say, yeah, that's just great, and then would there be other things that he would just be dumbfounded at or aghast at?
Well, you know, I wonder about that. One thing I didn't mention is that, you know, two journalists who won the Pulitzer Prize this year did a study. They write for ProPublica, and they did this analysis of this hedge fund called Magnetar. And the radio show This American Life broadcast it. You can find it online. It's a fantastic piece of reporting. And what Magnetar did on a large scale, what Goldman Sachs also did, is they created mortgage-backed securities designed to fail. And they were able to create them by taking a very tiny stake in them. But by taking a stake, they got other people to, you know, buy the rest. And by creating these things, they fed the market. And they were so flimsy that they helped push the market over the edge. And then meanwhile, they were putting their real money on bets that the market would collapse. So they not only, it's one thing to bet that the market will collapse, it's another thing to push the whole financial system over the edge. And so Vanderbilt did that, basically, you know, along with Jay Gould in 1869 when he contributed to the panic. He deliberately crushed Lakeshore stock in the market. He created a panic in Lakeshore, which contributed to the panic of Black Friday. And yet, you know, he then stepped in and helped save the market. And it's, you know, yes, it was in his self-interest, but at other times, too, I got the sense that as he attained dignity, he attained wealth, he sort of attained more dignity and more of a sense of, I am a business leader, and we have to watch out for the larger business community. And so, you know, I saw this on more than one occasion where he stepped in to help, before Daniel Drew got into his shenanigans with the Erie, Vanderbilt stepped in to help save the Erie before it collapsed, you know, when it was a very risky thing. So he had a sense of responsibility to the financial community along with this ruthless self-interest. It's very curious because it's not separate from his self-interest. He's not helped by everything falling apart. And yet I have the sense that he felt like it was a part of what should be done for a man of his stature. So, you know, I think he would, some of the most ruthless business maneuvers, he would totally understand it, but I also think he would disapprove as well. When you start getting into questions of, you know, what would he think about, you know, the bank bailout and, you know, the takeover of the GM and whatnot, that is a much trickier question. He probably would be opposed to it, but in the panic of 1873, he urged the Treasury Department to carry out what we now would call quantitative easing by releasing a lot of greenbacks that were in the vaults to create liquidity in the markets and basically to have them intervene with monetary policy. And so, you know, he was no purist. When the gold standard was a big issue after we went off it during the Civil War, he said, it doesn't matter to me. You know, $100 in gold, $100 of paper. He said that when the value was about the same. But he goes, you know, it's all the same to me. And, you know, he was very practical. So when he talked about regulation, he often said, I don't care what laws you make as long as they're general. Because if I can't compete on the same terms as someone else and succeed, I shouldn't be in business. So rather than having an ideological, rigid ideological view, he had a basic viewpoint, and yet when push came to shove, he was immensely practical. And as he said, as long as it's a fair fight, I can win. And I can usually win when it's not a fair fight, too. So, you know, it's a mixed subject.
Well, you've done a biography of Jesse James, Cornelius Vanderbilt. Can I ask who's next and what are the big themes? And most of all, when can we look forward to reading it?
Well, I just found out it's going to take a little longer than I hoped. I'm writing about somebody who, unlike Vanderbilt and Jesse James, like them, he's iconic, but unlike them, he's had a lot of good work on him and he's got a lot of papers, and that's Custer. And I'm interested in Custer because, like Jesse James and Vanderbilt, he was a physical, active, dynamic character. Vanderbilt got involved in fist fights. He piloted his own steamboat through the Nicaraguan rapids. You know, he was not a bookkeeper type. Jesse James obviously had an adventurous life. That physical drama adds a little extra element for me that I enjoy as a writer. But he also was caught up in all of the major conflicts in the Civil War and afterwards. And so what I want to do with Custer, rather than, you know, pretend that there hasn't been any good writing about him, I want to change the camera angle and look at him and his wife, Elizabeth Libby, in terms of a chronological frontier more than a geographical one. To look at all the different activities that he was involved in that were part of what we now identify as the making of modernity. Obviously, the creation of a unified nation state, you know, crushing separatist elements, whether they're Indians or Confederates, you know, ending slavery, enforcing new Reconstruction laws in Kentucky, where he was stationed, taking part in Wall Street with a mining company, being a new media figure, national media figure, writing for national magazines. I think at the Little Bighorn, he had a manuscript in his saddlebags, actually. He was a writer, and he thought of his life in a writerly way. And yet, personally, he was contradictory. He's not unique in this respect by any means, but he was a high-profile example of it, where he was still was very much the romantic individualist of the Jacksonian era. Very deeply racist, very much identifying with Southern planters, you know, unable to really be a good manager when management rather than combat leadership was needed in the army. He had real problems with that. Terrible on Wall Street. Was sued by his publisher. You know, he had trouble adapting to the very world he's helping to make. And that's really interesting, personally in his way of illuminating that world. So I want to look at him also in the context of some of the other figures who came out of the Civil War as much more recognizably modern figures, you know, disillusioned, sometimes cynical, you know, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Ambrose Bierce, the Adams brothers, a lot of the intellectual leaders after the Civil War, or major figures, had a much more kind of harshly realistic view of human nature. Whereas Custer was, you know, the dashing hero on horseback, in his own mind as well as to the public.
Well, maybe that's a good place to end. Could you all join in thanking T.J.? They say their books are available out front, and if I could see my students just for a minute here, that'd be great. Thank you again for coming.